Next up from the survey of formats, we'll have some words on strategies for preserving and managing. Chris Lesinick, our next speaker, is the president of Audiovisual Preservation Solutions, a consulting firm whose clients include the Library of Congress, Stanford University, Harvard University, Indiana University, Museum of Modern Art, and Witness. Chris is an adjunct professor in the New York University Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Master's Program since 2005. He is the chair of a number of committees, including the AES Standard Committee on Audio Metadata, AES Technical Committee on Archiving, Restoration, and Digital Libraries. He's the education coordinator for the New York Archivist Roundtable and a member of the ARSC and YAZA Technical Committees. Let's welcome Chris.
Thank you all very much. Let me just get set up here real quick. And thanks to Dave for that comprehensive and informative overview of digital media and assets. I'm going to focus a little bit more tightly on digital-born. The distinction that I generally make is between physical and file-based. So I'm going to focus on file-based assets. So Dave talked about a lot of digital physical assets, and I'm going to be sidestepping that a bit. So let me just get set up here. Yeah, that's my house in Patagonia. Let's see. Hey, there we go. Yeah. Actually, I was thinking we should, that'd be nice, is like have trusted digital repository will travel, something along those lines. Yeah. So I should clarify up front that while the topic of my talk is rather broad, digital preservation strategies, I'm actually going to be focusing in a bit and continuing where Dave left off and talking a bit about how to deal with these file-based assets that you'll be, are, have, and will be receiving in the future. And primarily, actually, I'm going to focus on a topic of conversation that came up a couple months ago when Dave started this whole idea of doing the presentation, and that was on, came out of that was obsolescence monitoring and normalization. So I'm really going to focus on those aspects as strategies for dealing with file-based assets that are coming into your archive. There's obviously so many great topics to talk about that fall under the umbrella of preservation strategies. Given the time, I'm only going to touch on a few. Dave reminded me of something very important that deserves special note that again, I'm not going to be dealing with, but data tapes that use third-party software as an interface to your content, that the third-party software is obsolete or will be in the very near future. There are recovery programs, but you lose a lot of structure and semantics and things like that. So those are of notable concern. And then things like the Pro Tools sessions of yesteryear that were never considered as ever going to an archive and preserving those things. Those are also greatly at risk. So, but moving forward, I like to always start a presentation by seeing what type of audience I'm working with here. So this is for you guys. I have a pop quiz. Fortunately, this is not your pop quiz. I have a different one for you. But the video I'm about to play, I'll set up for you. This is actually a great test of your abilities at this point, 4 days into a conference after lunch. It's the last session. I'm sure everybody's going to the business meeting after this, though. And if you can pass this quiz, Mike Casey said he'll let you transfer 8 cassettes of his at once. So I'll set this up for you. The video you're about to see is a complex setup consisting of 6 kids, 3 wearing black shirts and 3 wearing white shirts that are all moving around and passing basketballs to each other. What I want you to do is to count the number of passes that the 3 kids in the white shirts make to each other. And I'm going to ask you afterward how many passes. If you've seen this before, don't shout out the answer. Keep it to yourself. And here we go. Okay, let's hear it. How many passes? 17, 18. Heard of 16. Okay. Anybody see anything strange in there? All right. No, you're not supposed to shout out the answer. All right. Leave it to Steve. Give away the punchline. All right. So I'm going to play it again. And don't count this time. And just take a look here at what we see. All right, pretty interesting, huh? So the point of that, other than to give you some entertainment after lunch and to for me to test and see how awake you guys are, it's basically to make the point that when we have our attention focused in the wrong place, that we can miss rather glaring things. And when we're focusing on digital file-based content, we must adapt our focus and thinking accordingly. We need to be looking at a whole new set of parameters and activities. We don't want to get caught counting the passes of kids in the white shirts when we should be looking out for gorillas in the room. So while many things change, and that's what we're going to talk about, principles remain the same, and such as those listed here at the top. I've just rattled off a few off the top of my head, and below we see sustainability factors that I'll talk about later that come out of the Library of Congress website. That Carl Fleischauer is involved in. And these principles, the point is that these principles were just as valuable 50 years ago, and they'll be just as valuable 50 years from now. But how we apply them will undoubtedly change. And needs change. And this quote from Howard Besser sums up one of the primary shifts in need. And while this was regarding paper materials and digitization, it applies to us. And it makes the point of saying that analog, or I should say physical assets, persist by default, whereas digital assets languish by default. They take active management in order to persist. Now, fortunately, along with this new burden of file-based content brings along many opportunities for automation and efficiency that we never had in the physical domain. Aside from the recognition of this shift, interpretation of principles into practices, skill sets, and terminology also change. As an example of a shift in terminology with the focus on the principle of migration, with the arrival of file-based content, the distinction between the intangible object and the tangible object became meaningful for the first time, i.e. the difference between the sound that constitutes a track in a recording and its separation from its carrier. So preserving a recording once meant solely preserving the carrier. And while there is a strong and direct causal relationship between those two things, stated simply, we have realized that the object of preservation is indeed the essence, that the persistence of the essence, not the media, is the goal. So here is our essence, separated from all media and formats. Separation from the essence from the carrier causes a paradigm shift in the actions taken to preserve a recording. The question is no longer how can we ensure the longevity of a piece of media, it's how can we ensure the longevity of the recording. The answer to each of these questions is very different. They both involve migration, but approach from different perspectives. Migration used to be an act of last resort in the digital domain. It is a fundamental routine in the preservation of content. In a properly functioning digital preservation system, the media object is of little value. Assuming we have the proper infrastructure in place, we do not depend on an individual hard disk. A hard disk should place no signature on the content, and the survival of the content is not dependent on one hard disk. So when we worked with only physical, analog, and early digital technology, the recognition of the separation between the essence and the carrier was not useful to us. This was due to the fact that the processes used to migrate that essence were inherently lossy, which goes against the preservation principle of integrity and interest in maintaining quality. This is where we find the logic for reliance on the media that we've traditionally had. All actions taken and choices made in an effort to preserve revolved around the longevity of that piece of media. When a choice was made about media, an imprint was being made. From that point on, reformatting would mean loss, undoubtedly, so all focus revolved around the media object and the technology that revolved around it. It was only once digital technology evolved to the point that it could both capture an analog object without loss and also migrate those bits without loss that the separation between essence and the object became a meaningful observation to us. Along with this understanding came a division of terminology where migration turned into two new terms, migration and refreshing. There was no distinction previously. Both of these examples were called migration and constituted both refreshing and migration. So here we have from disk to tape and from tape to tape were both considered the same essential process. Refreshing now is the act of copying data from one piece of media to another. This counters obsolescence of degradation of the media, and both of these are examples of refreshing data. So from disk to disk and from disk to hard drive. Migration is now the act of mapping or decoding and re-encoding the essence into a new codec and or wrapper. This counters obsolescence of digital characteristics. Both of these are examples of data migration. So we see that we've gone from an AIFF to a BWF is the point here, while we've also moved to a different medium. So that was an example of terminology shift revolving around a principle. Now let's shift to practices and skill sets, which is it's ever important to reference OAIS. And what I find interesting about OAIS is that it often gets referred to in association with digital archives or file-based content and digital repositories solely. Almost never is it referenced, or it's unusual to be referenced specifically in regard to physical archives. I think this is often given the impression that OAS should only be considered for digital collections, but this is patently untrue. Rather, a lack of resources and expertise in archives has disallowed us as a community from performing these activities in the physical domain. But they were no less important 20 years ago than they are today. The opportunities that exist in the file-based domain in the way of convergence with information technology and expertise, automation, increased access leading to increased awareness, led to the uptake and enthusiasm of OAIS along with the file-based archives because it became a widespread reality to perform these activities for the first time. It is important to remember that just like our physical collections, our file-based collections require more than storage alone. Even the best of storage conditions, preservation was never really and will never really be about the ultimate archival preservation format that is so easy for us to focus on, or the ultimate archival storage medium. Instead, it's about principles and strategy. And as Ray Edmondson so aptly states, it is about the totality of things necessary to ensure the permanent accessibility forever of an audiovisual document with the maximum integrity. But it's one thing to look at the OAIS functions and to consider the totality of all things necessary, and it's quite another to interpret and implement them in an ever-changing technological landscape and with real-world constraints such as resource limitations and limited time. So let's talk about that a bit and the differences between the physical domain and the file-based domain. As a jumping-off point to get into differences, we'll start with one fundamental similarity. Accessioning physical and digital-born collections is similar in that archives generally have no control over the formats that they receive. The quality, condition, resolution, and so on is what it is. This causes major administrative problems, namely a wide variety of formats, each with distinct technologies and associated risks that are difficult to manage for preservation and access. In the physical domain, this problem has been exaggerated due to what we see here in this typical physical workflow, where many of the activities which enable intellectual control are backloaded, not being performed until migration occurs. And those would be what we see here, identification, inspection, documentation, content description. So the grayed out boxes are areas where I felt it was remiss not to add. However, it was being too generous to imply that these things are typically done. And while the timeline is not represented here, we all know that these activities usually take place over a very long time span in the physical domain. This lack of intellectual control that I'm talking about prior to migration has been truly crippling to many organizations. It has led and continues to lead to the inability to effectively prioritize, budget, and allocate resources. It is not uncommon for funds to be allocated toward migration of content prior to there being real knowledge about the content, its value, the media condition, or its uniqueness. Given the amount of content we have to preserve, think about the real impact of that for a moment. It's a truly stark reality. Fortunately, there are some positive movements on this front in the way of education, innovation, and more. On a brighter note, with the move to the file-based domain and the imperative of an actively managed environment, a change was not only required, but also possible due to the availability of a new tool set. This image shows a typical basic file-based workflow. In contrast to the long timeline necessary for the physical workflow, the timeline associated with this workflow could almost be, I stress almost be, considered negligible. There are so many opportunities to compare these workflows and to look at how preservation principles are interpreted into practices differently, but the areas marked with the three dots there are the ones that I'll focus on today. The activities represented by these dots, as I said earlier, are normalization and obsolescence monitoring. Not new concepts necessarily, but practically and technically implementable for the first time. We'll start with normalization. Now, normalization takes place at the point of ingest and is essentially proactive migration. It is not dissimilar in theory, and I stress in theory, from reformatting a variety of analog assets to one common file format specification. At the point of ingest, files are transcoded to one consistent file format. The basic logic of implementation looks something like this. And while this looks good on paper from a high-level perspective, technically and practically it presents some significant issues and challenges with what I propose only a couple of major real advantages. So consistency being one of those major advantages obviously is a great friend to preservation. It is not only good for immediate and near-term collection management, but especially for the next migration, which will take place beyond our current migration. It is certainly a nice ideal. With proper selection of a target normalization format, we greatly reduce the risk of obsolescence associated with other formats. So we can both gain consistency and avoid obsolescence. But the major practical issues come into play in the activities highlighted here. The reality is that with variable input of codecs, wrappers, and metadata, the task of creating and the transcoding and mapping routines is no small task and is fraught with difficult decision-making and challenges, especially as our digital packages necessarily become more complex. So ultimately, the cons are many. First, after scanning down a list of cons, you'll notice that as a sole tool, it's too blunt of an instrument. The task mentioned in the last slide is being challenging are time-consuming and resource-intensive unless there is a high level of consistency on input. On its own, it precedes attainment of intellectual control and repeats an error of the physical domain that I spoke about earlier by expending resources in an imprecise manner. Technically speaking, we face even greater concerns. For anyone who's been involved in a mapping project, you know what a challenge it can be to maintain structure, semantics, and relationships. These might include breaking connections with siblings and peripheral dependent documents, losing markers, losing metadata structure and granularity, and more. Additionally, when tools are being used in a broad sweeping manner with variable input, there's a real risk of poor transcoding and mapping, creating a low quality output as our master. Lastly, we see a practical consideration of storage, and Dave talked about this. The likely candidate for a normalized output would obviously be uncompressed. John, you can't leave during my presentation, man. Come on, is it that bad? All right. The result of decompressing to an uncompressed format is the worst of both worlds. The negative of a larger file coupled with the negative of the poorer sound quality. So for normalization, though, there are a couple of worthwhile tools here that I'd like to mention. And these are tools that are used Well, you can read up on them on the link. That, what I'll say is that, generally speaking, the DAI TSS tool looks similar to tools that many larger organizations may build internally themselves. It is a series of single-purpose utilities coordinated by a script. And for smaller collections or organizations without access to the appropriate expertise to use these programs, there are applications with graphical user interfaces that can be used in batch mode to perform some of these activities, although you will certainly hit an obstacle when it comes to metadata mapping capability. So now on to obsolescence monitoring, which I couldn't have found a better picture for. So obsolescence monitoring is a more sophisticated and complex mechanism. It's also used at the point of ingest, but it's also used at the point of access in a retrospective batch mode, so looking back at the content that we have existing, and on an ongoing basis, so scanning on a continual basis. Simply stated, obsolescence monitoring does a few things. It identifies and reports on formats that are more immediate risk of obsolescence. What we see here is a format identification, format lookup, obsolescence analysis, and reporting. And we have a bad report there at the bottom saying that we have a at-risk file that crosses the threshold of comfort. So, however, the processes involved are more complex than what we just showed here. This is a look at the basic workflow associated with performing obsolescence monitoring retrospectively or on an ongoing basis. So we see the files and metadata go through some ingest routine and end up in a repository. As they live on our repository, we have scanning, format identification, which then goes to be looked up in a file format registry. The information is pulled from the file format registry. There's an obsolescence assessment and notification of at-risk files. So I'll get into that a little bit more. In this example, this is a little bit different of a workflow. We see obsolescence monitoring taking place at the point of ingest. So in both of these examples, you probably noticed some of the things up there which are now shown as links, like UDFR, the LOC Sustainability of Digital Formats, Jove, Droid, and Aeons 2. These are all examples of applications that are required to perform the task of format identification, providing format lookup information, obsolescence analysis, and reporting. So format identification can be performed by Jove or Droid. Both of these applications will analyze and report, as well as Jove will provide validation information, whether it's a well-formed file. That information is then taken and sent to a file format registry. And here I have an example of an XML report from a file format registry on a B-Wave. So we've sent something to UDFR saying that we've got a B-Wave, and it sends us back a report with a number of fields. Sorry, the resolution is off. That shouldn't. You guys can't see everything there. But it sends us back quite a bit of, let's see, there we go. So technical information, so some technical metadata, but then also information about things like the level of available documentation, if there's an authority such as a standards body that oversees the file type and so on. So by the way, Jove, I should say, stands for JSTOR, Harvard Object Validation Environment. Droid stands for Object. Let's see here. Stands for Digital Record Object Identification. UDFR is the joining of the two previous main applications, which were GDFR, Global Digital File. Our format repository, and Pronom, they join together to create UDFR, which is the Universal Digital Format Registry. The LOC Sustainability of Digital Formats, as I mentioned earlier, here I have an example to show you. in where we have a WAV file format. I hope you don't mind, Carl, me showing off your work. Which again gives us a whole series of information, and here we see those sustainability factors and some discussion about each of those that I mentioned earlier. So disclosure, documentation, adoption, and how this file format holds up under those considerations. So ultimately, these data sources send back information to our system, and AONS, which is a project out of the National Library of Australia, receives it, and it's basically a somewhat of a workflow management in that it manages all the interfaces with these applications, but its core function is really about analysis and reporting of obsolescence information. So they've developed a database of criteria that they report on, and here would be an example of a report that they might generate. So you can't see the details here, but the gist of it is that red is bad, yellow is moderate risk, orange is, this is like the terrorist warning type of thing here. So it generates report based on the criteria that they've come up with, and would send a report saying, you know, which files are at risk and need to be dealt with. So the ones that fail, we see go to send an email or provide some notification to a manager of the repository. The ones that pass go through the ingest routine and into the repository. So the pros of obsolescence monitoring are that it enables a much greater level of intellectual control where reasonable, while simultaneously alerting you to high-risk issues. It places the prioritization and allocation of resources in your hands, which is what we want. It also maintains the integrity of the original intact and allows for adequate investigation of format nuances and functionality prior to migration. It relies on the community to maintain these tools, which is noted as a risk in the following slide of cons, but the benefit is also notable. The fact that it takes a community of people also means that those people are actively engaging and necessarily tuned in to the issues that affect us all. So it raises awareness and can provide impetus for ongoing community solutions. The main con is that these tools are still very much in development, particularly for audio and video, but that the integration of the tools and their exchange of data is in need of refining in order to function more smoothly. So in the final report from AONS that they published recently on their second go-around, they reported that there was still much more refining that needed to be done. And as stated previously, while it's sophisticated, it's also complex and requires some level of expertise to install and maintain. And as noted previously in the last slide, it depends heavily on others, which gives us less control, which can obviously be a bad thing. So this is a list of those tools. I'm more than happy to provide this slideshow so you don't have to write all these things down. And obsolescence monitoring on a small scale, when we think about it, I guess at one point that I don't want people to walk away from here and say, well, those applications, geez, we can't use those and they're not developed to our needs, is to think about still using these resources in a manual way, recognizing, you know, that there are some complicating factors with this fully automated solution. We can still do a great deal of good by checking in with UDFR and the Library of Congress sustainability factors and by applying those criteria. So it's less than ideal, but it's a heck of a lot better than nothing, and they are great resources. So normalization and obsolescence monitoring work best in tandem. As I stated, normalization is too blunt of a tool to use solely. And obsolescence monitoring eventually gets you to the question of, well, what do I do with failures, with the obvious answer of migration? So this decision tree, rather small text, sorry about that, basically shows the decision tree and the workflow of some of the salient ingest processes utilizing both obsolescence monitoring and normalization. So at the top, we see our document being submitted. It goes through the first decision that we see there is it free of viruses? So a virus check, which is a point of consideration that I'd like to throw out there. Many people are accessioning file-based content without doing any type of virus protection. The second would be a checksum generation if one does not exist, or a validation if one does exist. The third would be a metadata check to make sure that we have that the deposit meets our metadata specification. And then we move on to see here that this is where we do format identification. So here we would use Jove or Droid to identify the format. We do our lookup to the format registry. We get our data back. We come down here. We do obsolescence assessment, whether is it at risk or not. If it's not, it gets ingested into the repository. If it is, we have notification, a normalization process, and ingest into the repository. And what we see over here in this section would be the ongoing activity of scanning, identification, lookup to the format registry, and obsolescence monitoring and reporting. And then we have things like quality control. Looking for error reporting and ongoing monitoring of MD5 checksums and things like that. Okay. So I'd just like to throw out once again, I throw the sustainability factors in front of you so many times today because I refer to it commonly. I should have it tattooed on my hand. The sustainability factors I find extremely useful in evaluating not just file formats, but all forms of technology. When considering anything having to do with archiving and preservation, these are good criteria to use for assessment. But these are factors to consider. These are actually factors that I think are also useful in considering when in your archive is appropriate to use obsolescence monitoring and when is it appropriate to go ahead and do normalization. So, again, thinking about taking this on currently today, we may need to make some of our own decisions as opposed to being able to use Aeons to report to us which are failing and which are not. Other factors to consider are these: is what is your system report, right? So support, I should say. And that can speak to formats, bandwidth, resolution, and of course we're talking about archival systems as well as production and access systems. And what type of organization input do you have? So production-centric archives have potential control over the deliverable to the archive, so they can do a proactive, be part of the specification on what they're receiving. Uniform input is nice. It's a pseudo-control, I call it, because it's consistent enough that we can work with it easily. And then variable input, which is what we work with most of the time, is no control. So these are all factors to consider for, again, how to use obsolescence monitoring and normalization. So there's a couple of examples of this, and this is going to be really difficult, actually, since the resolution is different. I won't try to bring over the website. But these are two examples where you'll see some really well-documented practices and on how these two organizations are using both monitoring and normalization within their programs and their repositories, and have some great resources there for looking at and researching further. So with that, I'm done. Thank you very much.